My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to this week's Mysteries and Monsters. We've had another great week with lots of positive feedback on another episode covering Yowies. There certainly seems to be a growing appetite for the Aussie hairy man, so I think the fascination is going to keep growing. This week, I was delighted to be joined by Adam Benedict from the Pines Barrens Institute to discuss his fantastic book, Monsters in Print, which is a kaleidoscope of curious creatures featured in newspaper reports from the USA. It is an amusing, enthralling, and thoroughly entertaining book, and I recommend it for anyone who loves monsters, weird stories, and offbeat reports. Other than that, we'd love it if you could leave us a nice review on your podcast app, and please subscribe to us on YouTube to help spread the show and help us continue to grow. Especially as this month, the only two states in the USA where we haven't been listened to are Vermont and Alaska. So I don't know what we've done to upset the people of Vermont or Alaska, but wherever it was, we're very sorry, and we hope you please find us soon. Right. You can find us on Facebook. Our Instagram and Twitter feeds can be found at Mystery Monsters, and you can also support us for $1 a month on Patreon. And also, please subscribe on YouTube. Now, time for a trip back over to the pond, to Wisconsin, and to join Adam from the PBI. Adam Benedict, a native Wisconsinite, is a designer by trade and a researcher by choice. Drawn to the weird at a young age thanks to the likes of Robert Stack and Leonard Nimoy, Benedict has spent a good portion of his life studying up on the weirder parts of history. Realising that the knowledge he had gained might be of some interest to others, Benedict founded the Pine Barrens Institute in 2015. Since its creation, the PBI has become a well-received online gathering point for general Midwest strangeness. Adam, thank you for joining me today. How are we?
Thanks for having me. I am doing well. How about yourself?
Hey, we're very good and very glad to have you here today. Before we dive into your wonderful book, Monsters in Print, as I touched on in your introduction, as seems quite often when I speak to my American guests, Leonard Nimoy's In the Search Of tends to come up quite a lot as a catalyst for encouraging their love of the weird. So was that one of the points that really sort of propelled you towards this strange and wonderful subject?
Yeah. In Search Of and, you know, Unsolved Mysteries and stuff, that had a huge, huge grip on my childhood of the weird. I can also add in there, you know, like The Twilight Zone as well on the subjects that they touched on. Really, really took hold of my little kid mind and started shaping it to then where I was looking out for like more stuff along the lines of what they showed and, you know, eventually finding books that school libraries, school book fairs, stuff like that. But if I were to trace it back to the very beginning, it would definitely be Robert Stack and Leonard Nimoy for sure.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it is quite strange because I'd never seen In Search Of. I'd heard of it.
Really?
Because it was on in the mid 70s, obviously, when it was first shown in the States. It was on over here in the UK, and obviously I was a little bit too young, so my TV show of that ilk is Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, which happened sort of the late early 80s.
I can say for the In Search Of, because I wasn't there for like when all the episodes were new. I missed it by like 10 years.
Yeah.
But History Channel, when History Channel would redo their weird programming, you know, they do reruns of In Search Of, they do reruns of History's Mysteries, where each episode would be about a specific thing, whether it's lake monsters or, you know, aliens or Bigfoot or anything like that. So there was a good block of programming when I was young, before the networks went all crazy with reality shows, where it was just like a straightforward approach at like the paranormal and Fortean topics, where they took it seriously enough to do a good dive into the shows. And I miss that so much. I'll watch reruns to this day. I'm going through the entire Unsolved Mysteries backlog on Amazon Prime right now to watch it.
yeah, I discovered that about 6 months ago, and that was never a good thing. and YouTube, I think, is invaluable for things like that, like you said, because that's where I've I'd heard so many people on American podcasts keep mentioning it, and I kept thinking, I've never seen this program. Someone out there has put every episode on YouTube, so they're all on there. I think they've even got their own channel.
Yep, for the In Search Ofs, yeah.
So that's where I got them, and like you say, some of them were very academic in their slant, which is sadly missing from, I think, from most TV shows we've had since Monster Quest went off of the air, sadly.
It was nice because it hit that perfect time, you know, after the golden age of cryptozoology was kind of ramping down, but it was still taken seriously enough by groups of people that there was quote unquote experts that they could still talk to that had respect amongst other people, you know, in the scientific world. So bringing them on would bring that sense of, this is a legitimate scientific look at something that science can't explain. Now it's, you know, the people, anyone that they can find who might have shot one quick video, they're like, hey, you want to be on TV now? Yeah. You know, we're going to say that you're an expert and everyone's going to take your opinion for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it started in the paranormal, and then it's kind of infected ufology and cryptozoology, sadly. But ufology seems to have kind of shaken free of it a little bit recently, and that seems to be, I think, obviously in the modern climate as well, it seems to have had a real refreshing change to the way people have that conversation about that kind of subject these days.
Oh, for sure. It's definitely, people are looking at it. They're taking away that, that appearance of just being foolish. Now that, you know, the military is starting to comment on it more. They're doing, you know, they did that entire, although it was embellished, but for Hynek about Project Blue Book and all that. So people are starting to look at it more with, hey, maybe this isn't just all Hollywood. Maybe this is actually, you know, maybe it would be worth studying up on it. And, you know, maybe we could learn something. Yeah. And I'm glad. I hope that gets to, you know, cryptozoology again soon, because people are missing out if they think that it's all just, you know, a fool's game.
Yeah. I think the other thing that, in regards to that, I think what we have seen over the last sort of 2 or 3 years is because of how rapidly YouTube has sort of become a first choice for a lot of people when it comes to entertainment these days, Adam, there seems to be some very good solo filmmakers and small companies like Small Town Monsters, and there's a gentleman in Canada called Justin Chernopleski who runs Mountain Beat Mysteries, and they both make some fantastic self-funded films which are very much back in that kind of golden age style, where it's, here's the facts, here's the witnesses, what do you think?
What's great about that, especially Small Town Monsters, is everything they're doing has, you know, they've done the research, so they're not selling you anything that, you know, hasn't been written down and documented of the actual cases. They're talking to, you know, the witnesses, if they can, if they're still around, and all of that. But they're presenting it with, you know, like a Hollywood style where it's fun. People, you know, who might look at documentaries, you know, some people might think of them as boring.
Yeah.
Now they're coming on because it's got that style that keeps people interested. And then they end up learning something, and then, you know, they tell their friends. And I'm loving these serious documentarians and filmmakers that are going after a subject that's just been a joke for so long and making it serious again.
Yeah, very much so. I think, well, it's gone full circle, because it started off as quite academic, became entertainment, and I think it's drifting back to academic again, which can only be a good thing, really.
Yeah, completely agree.
So from that, those kernels of influence and excitement as a young man, when did you decide that you were going to set the Pine Barrens up? Because what I love about the Pine Barrens Institute website is it's extremely unique, or as unique as this kind of site can be, because it covers both a wonderful catalogue of historical accounts as well as more recent witnesses and sightings.
First of all, thank you, because I love hearing that people actually, you know, are seeing it as I was hoping that they would. So that's definitely a huge thing to hear. But pretty much what made me want to start it is, as I was saying, you know, when I started looking for the books and stuff when I was a kid, I'd start finding the information, you know, of the main stuff. Like, here's some info on Nessie. Here's some info on Bigfoot. Here's some info on, you know, they'd include aliens in it and, you know, just kind of lump everything together. But I'd eat that up, and then I'd want more, and then I'd find another book, but it was just the same stuff that I read before told a different way. Mm. So being younger, it was like, okay, I think I've just kind of figured out everything that you can. There was no place I was getting the information that I wanted. So as I was getting older and I was starting to look around for myself and being able to do research, knowing how to do it, I was coming across a lot more things that I never knew about before. And I was kind of keeping notes and files for myself. Mm. So I started getting so many files and notes and just general information that I decided, I'm going to start kind of cataloging them and writing them down, making it easier for me to find. I'd like share the information with friends and stuff, like, hey, did you hear about this? What happened up north? Or did you hear about this? What happened on the East Coast? And they all seemed like interested. So I figured, okay, what does everyone do in the, you know, the early, late 2000s? I'm going to start a blog.
So
I started a blog where I was just kind of writing these little stories about cryptids and monsters and stuff, and people enjoyed it. Mm. So then I decided, well, what if I just kind of made my own actual website, but now instead of doing the stuff that everyone else would write about, I look for the stuff that literally no one has heard about it, unless you start getting into, you know, page 12, 13, 14 of Google, where no one goes. And from there, it's kind of, you know, taken off. I wanted to present something. So, you know, when people start getting into this, you know, of little kids or, you know, someone who comes across it on TV or something, hears about a monster, that they'll be able to find it if they look for us, and they might be able to find something they've never heard of either.
Mm. Yeah. I must admit, you've become one of my go-to resources, because when anybody mentions, you know, not that I'm pretending I'm any kind of encyclopedia of cryptozoology, but, you know, I like to think I know a fair bit about quite a few weird and wonderful creatures. And if anything ever pops up that I've never heard of, you're one of the first ports of call I have, Adam, along with Dr. Carl Schuker over here and Lauren Coleman, because I think if these guys haven't heard of it, I probably don't think there's much to it.
Well, I super respect Carl and Lauren. That's crazy to hear.
Well, it's your own fault for being so damn good and well researched, Adam. I think that there's a lot of love that goes into what you do, and it's plain to see in the care and originality that the Pine Barrens Institute has.
I can to touch on that originality thing. When I first started doing it, like doing the blog and stuff like that, you know, I'd write something on, say like Mothman or something like Bigfoot, something that everyone knows about. And it was kind of like, okay, cool. This is getting hits. People are liking this, but I kind of felt like I was just doing what other people have done, you know, kind of just regurgitating the same info. And I didn't really like that feeling.
Yeah.
So I decided that, all right, since it's so broad of how many cryptids and weird things are out there, that, you know, someone, more than likely someone has covered it already. Mm. What if I kind of just focus on where I live?
Yeah.
Because not a lot of people have heard these stories. So, you know, I started looking around where I lived and then just started focusing on just Wisconsin and trying to get as many of the folklore legends and monster legends and everything I could from here to share. Cause you know, I'm a big proponent of the weirdest stuff you could possibly come across is guaranteed in your own backyard.
Yes.
You just got to look for it, because people don't like to talk about what's in their own backyard because they think their hometown is boring.
Yes, very true. Sadly, I think that affects all of us.
Yeah, and it's like there's one thing I could just, you know, kind of leave for people. It's just start looking at like your town's history. If you have a historical society in your town, ask if you can go through the records and the old newspapers and stuff, because you would be surprised at a lot of the stuff you would find.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've kind of got the bug in regards to that, because I'm trying to pull together a book on poltergeist cases, and I've been lucky enough to go to a couple of places in the UK and find the original reports of some very well reported cases at the time that just don't seem to be talked about anymore, Adam. So I completely understand where you're coming from in regards to that, and it's surprising what is often under your own nose.
Yeah, and it's like when you're lucky enough to come across one of those reports that, you know, history forgot, and you read it and you're just like, why would anyone forget this? This, like, this has everything that people nowadays want to read, you know, in a monster sighting or a poltergeist report or a UFO, anything like that. It just blows your mind how something can just get swept, you know, within the pages of history and no one ever talks about it again.
Yeah. I mean, it's happened. I mean, it's quite odd when you think about it, because that happened to Roswell, because it basically dropped off the radar, ironically, for 20 years, and didn't really kind of come back into fashion till the sort of late 60s, early 70s. It had just disappeared.
I think like when stuff like that starts happening, one thing that I found, which I really try and bring out when I do an article on something, is, you know, here's the main event. It's kind of like thinking of it like a pie or a pizza or anything like that. Mm. You have the main event in the middle, but there's going to be crust around it that ties back into the event. Like, why was something forgotten? Mm. Oh, because during this time there was a major flap of monster or UFO sightings. Mm. That explains why people kept jumping away and they forgot about that one.
Yeah.
Or why, you know, why is this looked at in such a way? You know, you go through the history, it's like, oh, this was the first one ever reported in the state. Mm. But it's like, if you just take the surface story, then you lose all that additional information that just adds to it and just bolters it up and makes it even better.
Yeah, I think that's always interesting, because I've often found it a source of frustration that Bigfoot is a prime example of this, where there is a train of thought in quite a lot of mainstream media publications that Bigfoot didn't exist till about 1957, and that's the first kind of reports of it, which I find both equally mystifying and concerning, because there's hundreds of years of oral native stories about this creature from all over the north of the United States and Canada, and I just find that baffling, that someone decides that, oh well, this is the first time it was mainstream media reported it, and that's when it began.
Right. And I can say, when, you know, when I started doing all, like, when I decided to start writing and stuff like that, I was a big fan of Bigfoot. I thought he was cool, you know, it's, oh, we have a monster everyone recognizes. But then, you know, over time and all the reality shows, and just it became more of a symbol for making money than it did for, you know, what it was originally intended when it was like being investigated and stuff like that. So my opinion on it completely swapped, and I was a firm believer that there's no way that this thing can exist. It can't. Now, as of right now, it's just, you know, it's just a symbol for people to exploit and make money. But then over time, as I started getting into like the historical papers talking about it, you know, when it wasn't referenced as Bigfoot, it was, you know, Wild Man or the Tree Man or things like that, where you wouldn't think to look under that term. And I started reading about the descriptions of it, and it's kind of like, well, wait a minute. Okay, now this seems more believable, and it started kind of swaying my opinion on it again. So now I'm back in the camp where I'm leaning towards there could be something, but not in the way that it's presented today.
Yeah, very true. I mean, I had a conversation with Peter Byrne for a special episode I'm doing later this year, and he just basically said, anybody that's seen it on the eastern side of the Rockies is lying. And that was it.
there's definitely people who, you know, they've gotten their theory, that's what they've studied, and that's what they're going to believe. I'm definitely one for I will accept what anyone wants to believe as, yeah, you know, that's your theory, that's your subject, more power to you if that's what you want to investigate. But I can't kind of narrow myself down to like one specific theory. I'm like firmly in the camp of it's 50-50. Either it's a real thing or it's not. Like, I can't kind of float between.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think with a lot of these things in modern cryptozoology, Adam, it can only be one of two things. And I've said this to a few people. You know, these people are either telling the truth or they're lying. There is no in between. It's not a gray area.
Right. And it's difficult now because there's so many people that you know, what's the word I'm looking for? People who are curious about it. You know, there's so many people that they could jump onto and watch their videos and read their stuff that they think that is the theory then that everyone believes.
Yeah.
So, and it's, you know, you get those theories like, oh, it can exist and not exist at the same time because it's magic and it deals with portals and it deals with all this stuff. And it's kind of like, oh, if that's what you not want to believe, okay. But, you know, just remember there are other trains of thought out there as well. Don't limit yourself to one thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. An open mind is often the only way to approach these subjects, I think, Adam.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if every theory was true, then Bigfoot is a multidimensional magic fairy living hominid from that survived across the world. They all can't coexist, and I think you're quite right that sadly, as in most fringe subjects, there is a lot of trench warfare, I should say, where my theory is the right theory and everybody else is wrong. And the other key aspects of your site and your book is, here it is, this is what it is, make up your own mind.
Yeah, I definitely, if I'm doing an article on something, you know, I want to present all the facts of the story. I want to give history of the area. I want to give some history of the time period. But I always try and end it with, but we don't know. You know, if you want to believe this, you can believe it. If not, you don't have to. Here's all the facts. Here's some reasons that it might have been something else. Ultimately, take all that and what you feel is best. That's what works for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the most balanced way to approach anything these days. And I think it's the only way we'll find out more, I think.
Yep, I 100% agree on that. Just read a lot. You just, you know, read a lot. And when you felt that you have a theory that works for you, then go for it. But until you're no longer questioning things, don't stop reading.
Absolutely. Never. So, talking of reading, let's get to your wonderful book, Monsters in Print, which has just recently been out. I think it's been out, what, a couple of weeks?
Yeah, I think it's going on about 2 weeks now in paperback version. A Kindle version just came out about a week ago.
Fantastic. An absolutely wonderful book, a collection of fantastic archive news stories from across the United States. What struck me in the introduction to it, Adam, was that when you kind of clarified, because I think it's very important, and I'll address what you say here, is that I really do appreciate the fact that you've kept the tone and the language used in some of the reports. And I think you discuss about how we view the past with a modern lens too often sometimes, and try and change culture and language and the behaviour of others to try and fit in with a modern interpretation of it, to kind of ironically whitewash parts of history away that some people are embarrassed about. But I thought I think it's important that you mentioned that, but I also think it was crucial that you kept these stories in their original format.
That's one of the biggest things for me is, I consider myself a historical purist, where I want the story as it was originally told. You know, if it offends me, if it doesn't offend me, that's how I want to hear it. And going from there, I can make my own opinions, you know, based off what it is. And I feel that if you alter a story in any way, regardless of the topic, you're losing something essential of that story. You're not looking at the story as it was originally told. Now you're looking at it through, you know, like upset or angry eyes, and you can't get the same experience from it. I wanted to keep everything the way it was, but I did have to point out, you know, that some people may be offended, some people won't. You just got to remember, though, this was a different time. Mm. We've learned from it. We're still learning from it. Don't be upset. You know, if it lights a fire inside of you, then, you know, moving forward, try and make things better.
Yep.
You know, the past is done. The future is the only thing that can be molded.
Correct. And I think, as well as that, like you say, and we've touched on in regards to how you usually present your work, Adam, you've just presented the stories as they were. There's no sort of adaptation. There's no kind of this story happened in this paper. It's here it is. This is where it's from. Take it as you leave it.
Yeah, that's one thing I was asking, you know, I was getting a lot of opinions from people. If people would, you know, enjoy reading it like that, because, you know, you get a lot of books or papers or movies, documentaries, whatever, where you're given the original story, but it's chopped up and it's changed and it's, you know, just kind of a footnote for the person who's doing it to then kind of spin it the way that they want. Mm. And, you know, you can go to a bunch of different sites for one topic, and you're going to read something different on every one. Hmm. So, you know, after talking with a bunch of people, it's like, no, yeah, people enjoy, you know, reading things as they originally are. People are going to like it. They're going to, you know, it's going to be a good reference. It's going to be, you know, a good collected work to show, like, the evolution, that this isn't just something that started happening now. This has been happening forever. Hmm. So I decided, yeah, let's keep it original. And, you know, that's why I included, after the introduction, I put that one little sentence, you know, everything you are about to read is real in the sense that it was really written, but still unknown if what was written really happened that way for real. Decision to believe is yours. So it's telling you right off the bat, these could be fake, these could be real. It's entirely up to you.
Absolutely. There is something, and I'm going to use this word in a positive sense, which could be unusual, really. The one of the things about the book that I really like is it's so frustrating, because there's so many of these stories and these news reports that you think, is that it? What else happened?
Yeah.
Surely that can't be it.
And like that,
it's a wonderful glimpse at the past, but it's compelling, and then you're like, oh no.
No, it really is. You know, when I was going through these, I had, you know, this is just 170 plus that made it into the book, but I probably have, you know, over 300, 400 that didn't, you know, make it in, where they were originally a part, and then I took it out because I felt that you can easily figure out what this is, or, you know, this isn't what they're originally talking about. But a lot of the ones I was gathering, I'd read it and I'm like, is that it? Am I missing, you know, a paragraph? And then I'd start going through all the papers. It's like, no, that really ends just right there. And, you know, 200 years later, I'm, you know, yelling at the reporter or the story writer who did this, like, come on, man.
Yeah.
give me more. There's no ending here.
Yeah. And let's be honest, there's probably a lot less going on than there is nowadays.
Yeah.
You've
yeah.
no excuse. Get out there.
And I will say, you know, anyone who asks, I'm not going to try and hide it. I guarantee a lot of these stories were written by sensationalist writers that papers hired to bring in more customers, you know, and buy papers. You know, it happens nowadays. People just do it on their own websites or magazines. But there's also in here, and you can tell by the writing style a lot, you know, even with today, talking with people who have seen something or experienced something, just the way that they tell it, you can tell that there is a truth to it. So it's kind of fun looking through these stories, figuring out, could this one be, you know, just a sensationalist piece, or is this an actual sighting of something? You kind of start looking through the words and you're like, what was the writer going for here? And then it touches back on what you just said, you know, and then it just ends, and it's frustrating because you you can't get the full picture because there's no one to talk to about it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the other added frustration is some of the older stories, you're thinking, I wish there was a picture, but obviously some of these stories even predate photography. So it's just like, oh.
Yeah, and there's a few of them in here that talks about, you know, a drawing was sent to our offices. It's like, cool, I'm glad you guys got that, but why didn't you put it in the article?
Yeah, thanks for telling us.
Yeah, I'm glad you described it really well, but I'd still like to see the witness drawing.
It all helps.
Yeah.
So, I mean, looking at some of these stories, let's talk about some of them, because I think we've danced around it quite enough.
All right.
I mean, the one thing I did notice about the book is that some of the early stories, there's a real obsession with sea monsters, which I find very interesting. I think that's a culturally significant thing. And I've seen a couple of books that are done in an historical sense. I was speaking to a gentleman called Jeff Holder the other week about poltergeists. And there's a real cultural shift in, because he's done a 500-year history of poltergeists in Scotland. And you can see the cultural change all the way through it. And there's a lot of that in this as well, I see.
There is. When it comes to the sea serpent or sea monster, you know, sometimes in this they call it the sea dragon. It's interesting because that's one that it's never gone away and it's never really undergone any major change. It's that one thing that literally sailed with people from country to country as they moved. So it's kind of like that binding agent that literally everyone across the world can relate to one another simply based on a sea monster. Like, oh, I've heard a story before. Have you heard of this one? Oh, no, we haven't heard of this one, but we've heard of this one. Have you? You know, and it gets people talking. It's just that it's that cryptid glue, essentially. That's how I kind of look at it.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. And one of the other key aspects of it, and the first story I want to touch on, it is quite salient because it seems to be undergoing a bit of a modern revisionism in regards to the history of this. And it's a wonderful story from the Spanish Folk Press in April 1929 from Utah about an Illinois farmer who had a desperate fight to save his son from the talons of a giant eagle.
And what's the name of the story? The Winged Monster?
No, it's Fights Big Eagle to Save Baby Boy. 325.
Okay. Yeah, that one is... there has definitely been a resurgence in giant birds as of late. And yeah, this one's a good one. I don't know if you want to tell it.
Yeah, no problem. So essentially, we'd got a farmer who was alerted to his child's terror as he was playing outside, and the screams brought the father towards his child, who realised that a giant eagle with a 12-foot wingspan was attempting to pick up his. And I love the description. It's a very polite description, because this child is 3 years old, and they say he's a stockily built lad.
Yeah. That one, I love the polite rudeness in a lot of these stories.
He weighed about 35 pounds. He's 3 years old. I think that we know what they're trying to get to. And because of this, the bird was unable to make great progress. Brilliant.
You can't fault the bird for trying.
Well, it sounds like it had no excuse. It sounds like it was going to pass up a good morsel there, Adam.
It's what I like about this story is it sounds unbelievable at first. You're like, why would an eagle, you know, try and take away a 3-year old and stuff? Mm-hmm. But then you hear about the reports, you know, of birds nowadays, you know, scooping up dogs from backyards, attacking. Geez, there's a video online of like an eagle swooping down and trying to pick up a deer carcass.
Yep.
Like, they can do it. So you read this and you're like, well, technically that probably did happen.
Yeah. I mean, there are photos of them taking lambs. You know, they are, and like you say, it seems, this is another strange thing I've noticed recently, is that people have only suddenly realized that large birds of prey may go after small dogs and cats, which I just find baffling that people wouldn't think that.
Yeah, it's like you're presenting a meal. Like, that's what they would, you know, look for in a forest with a large rabbit or a fox or something like that.
Precisely, yeah, really. And there's a lot of realism in this particular story as well, because it doesn't seem, other than the creature's size, it's not unusual in any other way.
No, there's nothing really monstrous about this in terms of being believable. It's just the size. And, you know, it goes into the father fought with it. You know, it had his neighbors came over and also fought it, because, you know, you took away its meal. It's going to fight back if it feels like it's in danger.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those. And there's a lot of these stories where people at the end of this, they either there's quite a lot of these monsters seem to survive these encounters, apparently. And they're all being sent off to either the Smithsonian or a local zoological garden. And nothing is ever heard of these creatures again.
Never again, which is incredibly frustrating, because, you know, I went to the Smithsonian for a field trip years ago when I was in middle school. Mm. And it's kind of like, where is this room that you're keeping all of this stuff? Because I know it's here.
Yeah. It's the door after where the giants are kept. Everybody knows that.
It's the basement under the basement. That's where the Ark of the Covenant's at too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's a cracking story, that, and there's a couple of those, and I'm going to mention another one later on. But the next one I'm interested in, and we've kind of discussed this in regards to you coming full circle on this particular subject, which is Bigfoot. And there's the story on page 81, which is two terrified hunters chased by an enraged maniac on whom they fired, from 1879. And once you read this is clearly a Bigfoot sighting.
Yeah, these ones, are definitely all right. Kind of let me kind of touch back. This theme goes across a majority of these wild man Bigfoot stories, where it's presented in such a matter of fact way, where it doesn't make, you know, they're not trying to make a monster. They're literally just describing this as if it's a hairy man.
Yes.
But, you know, they start giving like the size of it. They start talking about how it's covered in hair. It's all the things that we recognize now as a Bigfoot, but they would, to them, it's literally just a wild man.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're not describing a man with long hair and a beard. They're describing a large, hairy man.
Yeah, they say, you know, half man and half beast.
Yeah.
Because it was, they often describe their ferocity as being animal-like, but still they want to say it's a man because it looked like a man. They're trying so hard to not say it's anything but a man who just decided to live in the wild.
Yeah, and the other thing that strikes me about a lot of these early wild man stories is that the creatures they encounter are always very aggressive, which by and large is not a feature of what we would consider modern Bigfoot or Sasquatch sightings.
You know, I thought about that too while doing this. What happened, you
yeah.
know, if Bigfoot does exist, and, you know, it's that's a controversial statement in itself,
mm-hmm.
but if it does exist, is it unwise to say that maybe it did start out extremely aggressive, but as people encroached on the habitat, it had to learn that the only way to survive was to become docile?
Mm.
You know, if it's out there fighting people constantly, it's going to get shot or attacked. So maybe it's best to just kind of keep to itself.
Yeah.
You know, just one of them theories that these stories bring up. Because, like, yeah, this one, you know, it says yellow, brown hair and color, small eyes, face, but it was just terrible and it was ferocious. And is this the one where they shot at it or they had a posse going to look for it? I can't remember.
Yeah, they ended up firing at it. And were terrified regardless and ran off. And it basically shouting at them. And then when they got back, they said, right, they're going to get a posse and they were all going to go and look for it. And that's it.
Yep. They often describe it too as a full grown gorilla.
Yes. Which is interesting as well, because that's not a man.
No, right. It's like you can clearly tell the difference between a gorilla and a man, but yet they still try and say that it's a man who looked like a gorilla.
Yeah. It's peculiar. I mean, there is another thing I spotted as well, which you probably may have picked up on this as well, is there's quite a few of these stories describe it as having reddish hair.
Yeah. There's a lot of them where the color is often, if it's not black, it's reddish.
Mm.
You know, which is interesting because, you know, at the time of the Yeti's first descriptions and stuff, that's also described as having red hair.
Mm. Yeah,
so it's just one of them little links between, you know, and at this time, the Yeti wasn't known in the States.
Mm. I mean, even if you compare it, Adam, to the general population, red hair is not a common trait. So it's,
right.
Are we, because obviously some of these, there's always a story of a lunatic that ran off 20 years earlier and people think it might be him.
Yeah, they really try and link it back to that too.
Yeah. So are we
don't worry, it's just a crazy person who's, we can't find him. So, you know, he might attack your camping party, but don't worry, we're looking for him.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah. But are they suggesting that they all had red hair, all these people that went mad?
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
You know, I never thought of that, you know, by those statements alone, then there should be like this mental institution that they're talking about. Literally everyone in there should have red hair.
Absolutely. Well, it might have inspired. There's a Sherlock Holmes story about the red haired men, which is, which is equally odd because it's like I say, it's not a very common thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fascinating story. And for me, it's one of the best examples of what we would now consider a Sasquatch sighting, and it has all the ingredients, really.
There are a few too, like this story, you know, they take a shot at it and, you know, it gets away, it runs off, but there are quite a few in here where they do manage to kill it.
Mm.
Which is interesting because you don't hear those anymore. They do manage to kill the things that they're looking for, but then again, it just stops. They don't tell you any more information about it.
Yep. It's tantalizingly frustrating every time. jumping again, there's another interesting man versus eagle story, which is on 171, Story of a Curious Battle, from the Herald in California in 1893, about a telephone pole engineer who fights off a giant eagle with his hammer.
Yep. Bert, the story of Bert Barnes from San Fernando Valley.
I mean, it's remarkable because it's another very matter-of-fact report. There's no exaggeration. He's not saying anything unusual about this creature other than it's extremely large.
And I can believe this one without, you know, any hesitation, because we used to have a bird that lived around our house. You know, it was only a robin, but this thing hated me, where whenever I was outside, it would go out of its way to attack me every time it could.
Yep.
So to believe, you know, that a giant bird sees a man working on a telephone pole up in the air, it's not out of the realm of possibility that it's going to want it out of its area and it will try to attack him. You know, and I like the way this Mr. Barnes describes this, you know, because he was working on the telephone pole, so he's strapped to it, and his shoes have the spikes, so he's held secured, and there's literally nowhere he can go.
He is a sitting duck, ironically.
Yeah, and I think he said at one point he kind of had to take his shirt off to put over his head, you know, to keep the sun off of him, so he was, you know, in a position where he's going to get injured with these birds' talons. Mm-hmm. He can't do anything except take it and fight back. And yeah, all he had was his hammer, and he just started swinging at the thing every time it took a dive at him.
Mm. Yeah. And he's very matter of fact as well. I mean, the other thing that is interesting in some of these stories is there isn't much of a heroic exaggeration about how this brave man fights off this evil creature. He just basically says, yeah, I hit it twice and I knocked it to the floor. That's it.
Yeah. He just did whatever he had to do to survive. He described it as, he says, not the reporter, but, Mr. Barnes says, they say that when a man is drowning, thoughts of various kinds come to him. You've all heard that, but let me tell you another thing. When a man is on top of a telephone pole and a great brown bird with glittering eyes and open beak comes swooping toward him, all the stories he has ever heard or read of people being carried away by mother eagles to the nests of their young come popping into his mind quicker than you could say Jack Robinson. And between you and I, perhaps I was a trifle scared about the time I aimed that second blow. So this dude was legit scared that he was going to be carried off by this giant bird. And, He was going to do anything it took to survive.
Absolutely. And yet, once again, another monster that's captured alive, because he says, I'll sell it if anybody offers me enough.
Yeah, so, like, what did he do with it?
Where did it go, Bert? Oh, another one. Honestly, you could write a book on those kind of stories, I think, Adam, because it's incredible that, like I say, that's the only probably fantastical part of that story, that he stunned it and then he tied it up and took it home.
For I can say, when it came to the giant bird stories, researching those, and basically all of the stories in here, you have to get into a different mindset when you're looking for them during the time period, because, you know, now if I wanted to look for a giant bird encounter, I would, you know, naturally search like Thunderbird or something along those lines that we're familiar with recognizing giant birds. But back at this time, like, it was just a big eagle, a giant eagle. Mm. Like, there was no monstrous term attached to it, no recognizable monster name. Yeah. It was just matter of fact, this is a big bird.
Yeah, they are. And that is interesting as well. They are all feathered. There are no sort of pteranodon sightings or pterodactyls. They are giant eagles, nothing else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the next story I want to look at is very off track, because we don't tend to hear stories of such creatures in the Northern Hemisphere, and this is the Monster of Issyor, which is oddly a story printed in South Dakota, but covers a story in Paris, in France.
Yeah, the monster of I pronounce it. I don't even remember how I pronounce it. Issoyer? I don't know.
Listen, we're both trying to speak French, so I don't think it really matters how badly either of us pronounces it.
Issoyer. That's all I'm gonna say, you know? But it deals with a massive monster spider, which is not something that is unheard of, because, you know, the modern cryptid, the Yaba Fufi, is a monster spider in itself from the Congo, which has also had reports of something similar being seen in the United States.
Yeah, and I think spiders, more than anything, are probably what you would call probably the most misunderstood monster, because people have terrifying reactions to the tiniest. I mean, obviously, certain aspects, you know, these creatures can be highly venomous, so I'm not being flippant about it, Adam. But, you know, in the UK, we've got one that might give you a nasty bite, and that's about it. But the tiniest spider can create the biggest amount of fear. So for someone to come across a secret trap where a man-eating spider seems to live is probably most people's worst fear of all the monsters you write about in this book.
Yeah, especially a one that actively lures people to it. Like, this guy is reported as whistling, kind of getting its victims in a trance to come towards it, where they then fall into its web, where it can then consume them later. That is I don't like, my wife really hates this one. She hates spiders, and when I read this one to her, she wanted me to stop.
Yeah, well, it is very gory as well, and there's some weird things in it that it's a very peculiar tale, because there's obviously a large amount of people have gone missing. They all seem to disappear at night. There's this mysterious whistling, and the fact that the policeman that eventually comes to the aid of the area sees the witness, the last victim, sort of sprint towards it as though he was running to his own death. It's a very odd tale.
Yeah, it's kind of like a more monstrous version of like the Pied Piper. This one they try and explain it away too as, oh yeah, these spiders used to live back in the day during this specific time period, but they all went extinct. So this is nothing new. You know, and again, this one, it's sent off to a museum and it's never talked about again.
A group of heroic policemen as well saved the day. And I love it. It's probably one of the stories where it's got a dramatic death in it as well, because it's like, oh, stands up on its hind legs and then collapses in a shriek of pain.
This one would definitely be cool to see as like a short film.
Yes.
I want to see a squad of old-time police battling a giant spider underground.
Yeah, I think it's got a new Twilight Zone episode written all over it.
Yeah.
It would be a perfect 30-minute little segment, that, I think.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, because we don't get enough monstrous spiders, I think, since we've not had a good one since Arachnophobia, so I think we're overdue one. Mind you, Eight-Legged Freaks is quite good fun as well. So the next one is the story in the book that made me laugh the most, and I mean that most sincerely. And I'll read this one, if that's all right with you, Adam. And it's entitled Frog Rides a Bike.
One of my favorites.
From the Waterbury Evening Democrat on the 1st of February, 1898, from Connecticut. And it's subheaded, His Appearance Caused a Sensation in a Jersey Town. What looked like an Andaluvian monster rode through the town of Haddonfield, New Jersey, the other day, and occasioned great excitement as it scorched along the highway. The monster was unmistakably a frog, but of giant size. He was monstrous, terrible, appalling. Finally, a wheelman rode up in pursuit, and then another and another. The frog on the bike scared a horse, frightened a cow, and almost drew a bullet from the gun of a huntsman in a field. Dogs chased him, and small boys stoned him. The spectators who were at the finish were then treated to the greatest surprise of all. Instead of throwing the monster from his wheel and fastening with ropes, the pursuers gathered around, laughing and cheering. Then the big frog suddenly opened up and down the centre, and out from the interior stepped a man, panting and exhausted. It's just wonderfully silly, that story, Adam.
It really is. And I went back and forth on putting it in because, you know, it goes on to say that this was the idea of a man from the area for a race. They wanted to catch this frog, this giant frog, which was a man in a costume.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had 17 people on this bike race. I don't know why they decided like a giant frog, but so I went back and forth, like, this is clearly a man. This isn't a monster. But the way that they talked about it is people at first did think it was legitimately a giant frog riding a bicycle through their town. You know, people need to laugh. There's literally nothing wrong with laughing at, you know, certain stories in this field. If you're not laughing, then you're not enjoying what you do. So it had to be included because just the image of a frog riding a bicycle through your town at breakneck speed while kids are throwing rocks at him, cows are running out of the way, is just hilarious.
I mean, in my lifetime, Adam, I've had some pretty wild nights. And at no point in my life have I ever thought, I tell you what would be really good fun. Let's have a bicycle race with a man dressed as a frog.
Right? But imagine that now, like reading this story and someone's like, you know what? We're going to do that again. And it takes off a bunch of people in frog costumes riding around with like a mass of people chasing after it.
Yeah, well, you know where the fingers will be pointed, Adam.
I'll take the credit.
Well, I mean, there are stranger traditions. I mean, here in the UK, we have an annual cheese rolling competition where lots of people come from around the world and chase a piece of cheese down a extremely sharp incline, and several people break bones every year. So
I'm not going to lie. I have sat around before with a drink in my hand watching videos of that on YouTube, and it's always fantastic to watch.
Yeah, we specialize in weird ways to hurt ourselves. We're very good at that. We invent the strangest ways to do it, Adam. I think it's a British specialty.
Someone needs to go down the hill in a frog costume next.
Well, don't encourage them. There's probably rules. I think there are rules stipulated. You're not allowed to do it in fancy dress because you may even, you know, you may even like break your neck or something. It wouldn't surprise me. You can do it, but you just can't do it dressed up or something. But one of the other great stories, and it's one of those creatures that doesn't tend to pop up very often. I think primarily because of how large they were. And even in the modern era, there's only some sporadic stories from sort of Siberia, which have never really been verified. And that's mastodons or woolly mammoths.
I love woolly mammoths. I hope I am still alive when they do actually decide to clone one. So to come across like a few stories, I believe there's three in here, I found of surviving mammoths and mastodons.
It's unusual because at the time they weren't widely known, and there wasn't much of a distinction between them and elephants. And I just found it extremely peculiar. Out of all the monsters that are in it, it was probably the one, if you'd have asked me beforehand, I'd probably struggle to have thought of.
Yeah, a lot of... And it, which is funny to me because, you know, we still get people giving reports of surviving dinosaurs in some way, whether it's not usually, You know, back in the day, it used to be giant dinosaurs, like, oh, I saw a T-Rex in the desert. But now it's, you know, like smaller dinosaurs people claim they see.
Yep.
But if that, if people can believe that, then the possibility of believing in a surviving mammoth is literally just as possible.
Mm.
You know, especially now, I'm not saying that they do exist, you know, but I'm saying that even scientists themselves, you know, are confident enough, if they were to clone and bring one back to life, it would survive in today's, you know, climate and locations that they would put it in.
Mm. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, obviously, along with the thylacine, it's probably the two most well-known extinct animals that we know people are desperately trying to clone.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I often wonder what they'd do with them, if I'm honest. I mean, where would you put them?
I believe last I heard, there's a research team around Siberia that would be setting up a preserve in their wilderness out there, which these mammoths, if they ever do clone them, would survive in. But this story is interesting because they claim that the mammoth that they saw, or the mastodon, was seen going into an active volcano.
Mm. It's that.
So it's kind of like, one, why would it be going into a volcano? Because no animal would actively try and go into a volcano. But two, it's kind of like, why would they make that story?
Yeah. It's perplexing because at the end of the day, you don't need to add anything to the story of seeing a woolly mammoth walking around.
No.
But to then say, oh yeah, and then it went inside a volcano. It's one of those, it's either so far-fetched it had to have happened, or it's just pushing the boundaries of reason, I think, Adam.
I like the dude who says that he saw it, because he goes on to say that I am a fantastic hunter. I've hunted everywhere.
Yeah.
My father was one of the most famous rifle shots in all of Ireland, and I've hunted since I was 8 years old. Yet I have never seen what I saw. Mm. So I don't know. It's just one of those questions that, you know, you put the book down and you just kind of, you'll think about it later, like, what did he see? Did he see anything? Is this a real story? Is this a fake one? Well, now I'm going to have to do some research on it. And that's if you go out and you do research after the fact, then I think the book has served its purpose.
Yeah. I think that's sometimes what makes some of these reports compelling, is that, and it's same in the modern era as well, Adam, that I think when you get a report from a certain person, such as, you know, we're referring to this gentleman who saw the mastodon as, you know, basically giving us his hunting resume as sort of bearing witness to his experience and knowing exactly what he'd seen. In the modern era, I tend to take those kind of reports in regards to Bigfoot and Sasquatch and other strange cryptids with a little bit more credence than I would a general member of the public, maybe for better or worse.
I do too, to a point. This is just my way of looking at it. If a person in a story, or if someone sends something to me, or, you know, I read about it on someone else's page that I respect, anything like that, if they make note to themselves, like, one time, like, I've spent time here, I've done this, and that's it, then it's like, okay, yeah, this person is a trustworthy source. But if they keep finding a way to, like, push their accomplishments in there, it's kind of like, is this not actually genuine? And is this just a way for this person to get their name out there? Like, look how good I am at things. It's that weird ground that I've found. The people who have an experience like this usually just like to tell the experience, like, this is what I saw, maybe you can help me. The ones who, like, really like to go into it, and I'm not saying this is everyone, so
yes,
you know, anyone listening, don't take this as, oh, all these people that do this are frauds.
Yes.
But it's kind of like, you know, the known hoaxers out there. This is something that they really do. They like to be put in the spotlight. They like to have their accomplishments really put out there. So I don't know. it's one of those things where I kind of float back and forth between believing and not believing.
Yeah, it's interesting, I think. But I mean, there's a famous interview. I forgot the gentleman's surname. He's a world famous taxidermist, Canadian chap called Ken, and he's been interviewed about Bigfoot, and he is incredibly compelling when you listen to him because he's just very matter of fact about the whole thing.
Is this the one who's doing the documentary called like Big Fur or something like that?
It might be. Yeah, I think he's called Ken. I can't remember his surname.
I think he did like the taxidermy mount of a Bigfoot. Yeah, that I've heard him talk before, and the mount that he made is more believable to me than a lot of the, you know, drawings or sculptures or things of other Bigfoot that people have seen. There's something extremely genuine in what he's saying that it makes it very difficult to doubt what he's saying.
Yeah. And he's another one, like I say, he's very straight to the point. He doesn't dress anything up at all.
Yep, just give them the story and people, this is what I saw, I know what I saw, and if you don't believe me, that's on you.
Yeah, very true. One of the final stories I'll touch on is another one that's unusual because once again it's not a creature that tends to be reported much of this day and age. I know there are some reports out in the Pacific of a creature called an Ahu, I believe, which is supposed to be a flying creature that emits light. And this story on page 250, a winged monster. The thing that struck me about this is this creature seems to be like some kind of giant glowworm.
This one, now this one actually has a lot of history that happened after these stories. For anyone familiar of the Van Meter Festival in Iowa, this creature is kind of like described as a almost like a pterodactyl with a flashlight on its head. But what's weird, like this is the first time I've ever seen like the actual article without any of the later on embellishments of it, where this, if this is all that was out there and I never heard about anything after this, I would legit take this as some sort of, you know, pterodactyl giant bat like thing flying around that just so happened to find its way into a town one day and then moved on. It's a very weird story.
Yeah, and it's striking in its originality in comparison with a lot of them, because a lot of stories at the time were the usual traditional ones, Adam, that we've touched on. You know, we've got giant birds, we've got lake monsters, we've got sea creatures, we've got wild men who clearly are not just men running about. And this one's very odd in the fact that it's quite distinct from quite a lot of the other stories you've uncovered.
Yeah, the Van Meter monster is definitely an interesting one. I only know about it limited from what, you know, I've gathered here and there. Definitely, if this is something that people are interested, there are a lot of resources to learn about this one. This is one worth checking out just because of how original it is in the terms of the cryptid monster world. But basically what happened, this thing showed up in town one night. And it could emit a light from its head and it would fly around and it was looking kind of into buildings and people were taking notice of it and like wanting to defend their town with weapons from it, and eventually chased it into a cave where it and another one flew out later on and seemingly left the area. They're not really sure.
Yeah. And it's one of those where it seems to be. It's one of those stories that happens over consecutive nights as though it's building to some kind of climax as well, which is quite interesting as well in the way that the story seems to be a serial of events.
Yeah, it's like the first time it's seen, people are like, oh, okay, that could be something, whatever. But then it's seen again, and then it's seen again, and it's only in this town. And, you know, it builds up to that the townspeople have to defend where they live kind of a thing. Like a classic 50s monster movie. Like, let's gather up a posse and we'll chase out the monster. It's either going to leave or we're going to kill it kind of a thing.
Yeah, and the story does finish like a sequel, doesn't it? Because two return and disappear down the shaft.
When's, it's like, where'd they go?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story because it's, you know, and there's also the reports of it being impervious to bullets as well.
That seems to be a thing a lot with a lot of the stories you'll come across in here about, like, lake monsters or sea monsters. They will take bullet after bullet and never have any harm from what the people, the witnesses say, which is very interesting. Like, are they missing the thing? They really think they're hitting it. Are they hitting it? And, you know, they just don't have the weaponry to pierce its hide, you know, kind of like an elephant or a hippopotamus at the time. And it kind of gets you thinking, if these things are real, then what, biologically, what are they more like? Mm. It just raises those questions that, you know, you wouldn't normally think of if you get the story like from TV, a documentary or something like that. You know, you're giving all that information, but when you're getting it from the time that it happened, you know, you kind of have to start thinking about it in your own terms. Well, why would it be like that? Why would they describe it like that? You know, and it's interesting that so many of these can be linked by those little details, like skin type or, you know, foot type, or like in terms of the Sasquatch, hair color, stuff like that, which makes it more easy to believe, because over the course of all these years, they're still hitting these fine points repeatedly. You know, if someone's making it up, why wouldn't they say that its hair color was, oh, this time its hair color was white, or this time, you know, the creature was purple. Why would they keep going to the same things every time?
Yeah. Well, we live in hope that somebody may see a blue or a purple Bigfoot. I mean, that'll be a story and a half for anybody to come out with, I think, Adam.
They'll definitely try and link it back then, saying that definitely escaped from like a circus train.
Yeah, one of those many crashed circus trains that seem to litter America around the 19th century, if you read most newspapers, I think.
Yeah, which is funny because no town ever remembers a circus train ever crashing, but they're kind of like, well, if you guys reported it, I guess it happened.
Yeah, it is one of those things. I'm trying to think, is it Joshua Cutchin, I think, really did some work on this, trying to sort of compare stories of sort of wildcats and Bigfoots to train crashes at carrying circuses around the States. And they don't tend to match up very well.
No, the only like major circus train crash I can think of, you know, happened in Chicago way back in, I don't know if it's the specific date, but I want to say around the 20s, but you know, it made the news, where there is a special section of the cemetery for everyone who died in that train crash. Yeah. So if a circus train did crash in some town, you think that there would be many, many articles about it.
Yeah.
Not just one mention.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, it's definitely a chapter that you would expect to find on something like Atlas Obscura, because they thrive on things like that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and you never do. One of those things to ponder.
Or it's just that one of those wonderful go-to excuses like swamp gas, Adam, that everybody has.
Well, everyone knows that all UFOs are swamp gas. I mean,
yeah.
But no one can ever describe what swamp gas looks like unless it looks exactly like a UFO.
Well, that's the thing. I've never seen swamp gas, so I don't understand what these people are talking about.
I mean, if it looks like, if you mean swamp gas looks like a metallic craft with lights on it, then yeah, I guess I've seen swamp gas.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Right. I think that the last story I'll touch on is on page 57. And I've picked this one out because of its age, Adam. And it's vampirism in Serbia.
Well, this is a sad one to me. This is depressing.
What strikes me about this story is it's published on the 14th of August 1876, and Dracula was released in 1897. And it's that that strikes me about it, because it's not probably a cultural superstition as much as it used to be. It's probably the one of the other subjects I didn't expect to pop up in the book, because it's not something you kind of expect to see in the modern era.
Yeah, this is one. A lot of people who have read it have mentioned this one, that they weren't expecting to see a story about a vampire show up. But, you know, vampires are technically, they're considered monsters, more so folklore monsters than anything. But at one point in time, they were considered real flesh and blood monsters. And this, I think it fits in nicely amongst here, just kind of to set that tone of what people believed, you know, was going on when dealing with a quote unquote vampire.
Yeah, it's peculiar in the fact that it is a traditional belts and braces vampire story of a poor innocent victim being visited by a ghastly presence. It's everything you would expect to find in a vampire experience.
I like the fact too that it's written from the point of view of a person who is just kind of like experiencing it for the first time too. You can easily put yourself in the experiencer's place and pretty much feel the exact same thing that they would be.
It's interesting to me because there are some aspects of this that do chime with Dracula as well. And I found that quite interesting about the fact there's some real things that we still see in some classic modern horror films, some, you know, modern versions of Dracula, about, you know, the small village on the outskirts of nowhere, and everybody in the area seems to know what goes on, and a traveler discovers it for the first time.
Oh yeah, it definitely, it really resonates with those themes that, you know, the old Hammer films and Universal films really try and get across, of, you know, being an out of place visitor who's thrust into the situation that they were definitely not expecting. I can say with this one, when I came across it, one of the main reasons that I put it in here, you know, again, you know, touching on the vampires being a monster thing, is just, it's so well written that it's a miniature story in itself, that it's got a definite beginning, middle, and end, and you really start rooting for the people that are in it. And I don't want to like spoil it for anyone, but you definitely wish that you could change what happens. You really do.
Yeah, it's very well written as well. So it's clearly from an educated man who, you know, goes into some detail about the whole situation, and it's very peculiar. Wonderful,
yeah,
story.
It really is. I really wish that this person who wrote it, if they have, you know, more stories about their travels and everything, and if they have a book, if there was a way to find that, I would love to read what else this person experienced in their time abroad.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a travelogue I would be interested in finding out. So, Adam, once again, congratulations on this book. It's absolutely fantastic. It's chock full, over 400 pages. It's superb. And there's a bonus chapter in towards the end, which I found a nice surprise that you'd collected some specific stories about a particular trend of weirdness at the turn of the last century. So that was a nice twist as well.
Thank you. I can definitely say, just for anyone that's curious, out of the entire book, there's two stories that I absolutely love. And it's one of them's called Marine Monsters, which is page 137. And it deals with a boat being attacked by a whole bunch of monsters with arms, and they're climbing on the sides of the ship, and the crew is battling them at sea, which is a great story. It's a good read. And then there's another one who believe that a ferry boat is a monster, and a posse tries to go kill the ferry boat. So that alone, you know, kind of sums up what I was hoping to accomplish and just give people a big wide range of stories that they could enjoy, you know, just kind of pick up randomly here and there, sit down, oh, I'm going to read a few stories and then be done with it. Something, you know, I had in mind like good campfire stories or stories to talk about like at a car ride or icebreakers or anything really. These stories can be used for anything. And I really hope that people who get this appreciate that and can just have fun with it. That's what I was going for. I hope people have fun with it. And if they do, you know, I think it's an accomplishment then.
Yeah, very much. I think it is one of those books where you can take a bite as large as you want out of it and still come back for more.
Yeah. You're hitting everything exactly that I hoped. That I hoped you would.
Excellent. So listen, Adam, where can everybody purchase the book, first of all?
The book can be purchased on Amazon. If you just type in Monsters in Print. Also, if you go to our website or my website, I always say we when talking about it, but to put it out there, it's literally just me. If you go to pinebarrensinstitute.com and under our shop, there's a link that'll take you directly to Amazon to purchase it. Also there, we got like random shirts and stuff too. But yeah, it can be found two places.
Fantastic. And obviously you're across all social media platforms, so everybody can just Google Pine Barrens Institute and pick you up wherever, can't they?
Yep. If you go to Pine Barrens Institute, we got links to, we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook. I'm not so active on Facebook, more so active on Instagram and Twitter. Twitter is at PBI_crypto. And Instagram is just Pine Barrens Institute. You'll find it's just a hodgepodge of stuff. You know, it's shout outs to our friends and colleagues. It's talking about soccer. It's talking about movies. It's, you're not just getting monsters. This is a whole bunch of stuff. It's a grab bag.
Yeah. My Twitter social media feed falls in that camp as well.
I don't have enough stuff to talk about. If you just want monsters, I believe me, there's a lot more better people that's just going to give you that. But if you want just, why is he posting this? Then definitely come on board and join me.
Big time. I completely agree. So listen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure to finally speak to you after playing email tennis for a couple of years, Adam. So
I had a blast. Definitely a great conversation. Thank you for having me on.
Hey, my absolute pleasure. Good luck with the book. Hope it sells by the bucket load. And we will speak to you again sometime. You take care.
You as well.